Okay. So, again, welcome to any parents who've joined us. If you have questions and you want to type it underneath the link in the Facebook Live, Ellie will read it to me. I can't see it right now. I'll try to respond. Okay. So, the yeshiva this year has been learning Masechet Avodah Zarah, which deals with not per se the prohibition against idolatry, but various rabbinic obligations to distance oneself from idolatry. So I figured that since we are at the end of the secular holiday, or not secular, the Christian holiday season, which is less felt in Israel, but for those of you who are in America right now, is quite palpable, to discuss some of the practical elements that emerge from what we've been studying, and how it applies. And in general, navigating the holiday season in a majority Christian culture does take a little bit of knowledge of basic halachic issues, and I want to discuss very briefly three of them. One of them is holiday parties or office parties or end of year parties. The second is going to be holiday greetings, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and the like, and potential issues that arise there, and gifts. Office gifts within the office, gifts to your mailman, I don't know, whatever you do, right? End of year to your super if you live in an apartment building, whatever the case may be. Okay. Okay. So, like I said, these will be briefer discussions, but I just want to just sort of touch on some of the practical issues that emerge. The first issue we'll deal with is parties. Now, 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, if you asked people about parties, usually what was the issue that they were worried about? Why did people think that end-of-year parties would be problematic? Because what were they usually?
Promiscuity.
No, not promiscuity. What? I don't know what parties are going. I mean, maybe, but
Not
pagan, they were Christmas parties. Right? They were Christmas parties. 15 years ago, they were Christmas parties. 20 years ago, they were Christmas parties. So people wanted to know, could they partake in a celebration of a foreign religion? Now, that raises all types of interesting halachic issues, but the truth is that at least on the East Coast, this is less of a thing nowadays due to the general, multicultural, pluralistic, tolerant, PC culture. Yeah, Ellie.
There's a question.
Yes, already. Okay.
Can you wish someone a Shana Tova?
Yeah. I mean, New Year? We'll get to it. I don't know who's asking, but we will get to greetings.
Tzvi's father.
Okay, so we'll... Okay, so we'll deal with it. We will deal with it. The third thing we'll deal with is greetings. Unless you want to skip to greetings, but I'll try to go in order of the sources. Like I said, 15 years ago, people were asking about Christmas parties. The truth is that most of the shilas that I've heard in the last few years and talking with other rabbis, this tends to be the case. This isn't such a thing anymore. Because of this multicultural push, most what used to be Christmas parties are now called holiday parties, generic holiday parties with like a Christmas tree and a menorah and, I don't know, happy Kwanzaa, happy whatever, right? Or they're end of year parties or something like that. Very rarely are they, unless you're working for like a devout Christian organization, they're just not usually exclusively Christmas parties in the sense that you could look at it and say, I'm participating in some foreign religion. So in general, the halachic issues we end up dealing with are more generic, right? Are the potential problems in a party, in a non-Jewish context more generally? Now, this is a topic that at least two of the shiurim have dealt with. With me. When Roy Ginsberg goes away, you both did it with me. So for you guys, this will be review. For the guys in Roy Chait's share, this will be a little bit new. But what potential issues could there be? So the Gemara in Source 1, I'm gonna read it in English. I hope you guys don't mind. You've looked at the Hebrew, but I'm going to go through it in English unless necessary, because I know for some people listening, that's going to be a bit easier. So it was taught in a Braita. Rabbi Shmuel said, Jews in the diaspora are worshipping idols in purity. Rabbi Yishmael introduces this cryptic statement that Jews who live outside the land of Israel, they're worshipping idols in purity, meaning they may not realize they're worshipping idols, they may not want to worship idols, but they are. That is the reality of their life. Right? They are worshipping idols. Now this is something that actually appears several times throughout the Masechta, throughout the tractate, Sugya a little bit later, and Yud Bet and Yud Gimel in 12:13, discuss the reality that many people living in non-Jewish societies, the simple act of going to a market, a carnival, or pretty much any place where you're buying things could be idolatrous, because there was a head tax or there was a sales tax which went to support idolatrous organizations. Right, so there are several instances in which the Talmud notes that whether or not you realize it, when you're living in a true idolatrous society, you may be involved unwittingly in the support of these organizations. Now, obviously, the tax issue has sort of been ameliorated when you live in, I don't know, the United States, where there's ostensibly a strong divide between church and state. You don't get this quite as much. It's not true in all countries in the same way. Even Canada, that's not true. Canada, the Catholic schools and not Jewish schools are supported by the government, at least in Ontario. So it's not true everywhere. But the Gemara introduces this notion. So what does that mean? So it says, well, how so? An idolater will make a feast for his son and invite all Jews in his city. Even though they eat and drink their own food and they have their own waiter, the Torah considered it as if they ate sacrifices of the dead, which is a euphemism for idolatrous sacrifices. As it says, and he shall call to you and you shall eat, that should be eat, from his sacrifice. And say he does not violate until he eats. Rava said, if so, it should say, and you ate from a sacrifice, what is the import, and you shall call, and he shall call to you, that you violate from the invitation. So what does the Gemara say? What does the Talmud say? The Gemara says that if one is invited to a party by a non-Jew, a party not necessarily just a social gathering, but a first-rate social affair, a wedding, let's say, a gala, a dinner, something along those lines, even accepting the invitation is already prohibited, and for sure going to such a party. Now, we discussed a bit among ourselves the possibility that this invitation qualification may also define the type of party we're talking about. It may only be the type of party that is significant enough, that is formal enough, that it warrants an invitation. Anything of a lower level which you don't need an invitation is less problematic. But the Gemara introduces this notion that you can't attend in a party of an idolater. And in general, while the words used are idolater, and there are some achronim who suggest, there are some later authorities who suggest that maybe these prohibitions should be limited to idolaters and therefore should exclude, particularly in Israel, this is important, Muslims, and Christianity, as we'll see, is the subject of dispute. The general assumption is that the issue at hand is not idolatry per se, but rather it is joining these non-Jewish parties at all. Now, why would it be prohibited to go to a non-Jewish party? Right? What could be problematic about this if it's not idolatrous? So there are basically two main positions that emerge. One position that emerges from very strongly from Rav Shabtai Cohen Rappaport in the Shach and Nekudat HaKesef, and it is raised first as a possibility by Yeshua Falk and the Drisha, and this is number four, is that, as I mentioned, the entire tractate of Avodah Zarah, especially the first chapter, introduces a series of rabbinic prohibitions that are meant to, as much as possible, make it that you don't participate in idolatrous culture, and idolatrous holidays, and idolatrous culture, and idolatrous anything. And therefore, the Talmud, the Mishnah already prohibits doing business with non-Jews in 3 days before their holidays, possibly 3 days after their holidays. So there is this notion that this, too, is fundamentally about distancing people from idolatry, from worship of idols. Most authorities who believe that also think that this prohibition, like most of those mentioned in the first chapter of Avodah Zarah, are rabbinic in nature. If that's the case, as is true of many of the rabbinic laws in the first perek, and right in the first chapter, what is often true of them? They have an exception. What's the exception?
Eva.
What's Eva?
Hatred.
Animosity. Hatred's a bit strong, but animosity. Right? Meaning any time the prohibition in question will create undue animosity, so that wasn't included in the original decree of the Mishnah, and therefore the prohibition is waived. And for that reason, the early authorities, the Rishonim, note that while the Mishnah says you can't do business with idolaters, among other reasons, Jews in the Middle Ages, and obviously Jews now, did business with non-Jews because they recognized without it they would collapse financially, they would create a tremendous amount of animosity if they cut themselves off from the non-Jews. And therefore, the early authorities argued that this wasn't under the prohibition at all. If this prohibition of not going to parties with idolaters is the same, so then in a case where it's going to create animosity, a tremendous financial loss, couple that with the fact that we may not be dealing with idolaters, because you may be dealing with a non-religious party, you may be dealing with Christians, who, as we'll see, is itself a dispute as to whether it's Christianity, Muslims, who are clearly, almost according to all authorities, are not idolaters. Add that all together, and whatever exactly the prohibition is here, it would be easily waived, and you could say you're allowed to go to the business party, the office party, the end of year party, the holiday party, whatever it's called, because often it is important for someone's job to be part of the team, to be part of the crew, to be part of the guys, to run the guys, to not be standoffish. And at least coming, showing one's face is important. That would be one school. There is a second school, however, who understands this not as a similar law to those found in the rest of the first chapter, namely those which are rabbinic prohibitions to distance you from idolatry, but rather they're part of a different set of rules, possibly biblical, which are meant to, who remembers? Right?
Causes.
Right? Good. To minimize interactions with non-Jews, which might lead to everything up to and including intermarriage. Okay, that's my formulation of the Rambam. But if you guys remember, often is formulated technically as chasdus or chatnut, right? That there are things that create that prevent intermarriage. However, there is a bit of an ambiguity about what that means. While some Rishonim, if you remember the Tosfos Rid, Avodah Zarah Samech Hayom Bet, suggest that chatnut literally means that we prohibit these things to prevent the possibility that you will intermarry, right? And he's very, right, if you remember, he illustrates this very nicely, that you'll be invited over to your friend's house, and his daughter will be a very good cook, right? The whole story. That is one way of understanding it. The way the Rambam understands it, the way Maimonides understands it, is that, no, chatnut is a stand-in. What it means is that sometimes we don't want you involved in idolatry, and sometimes we don't want you involved overly much in an overly social context with non-Jews, because we recognize that if you immerse yourself in a non-Jewish culture, it can lead to a series of halachic problems, up to and including intermarriage, but not limited to intermarriage. It could lead to eating not kosher, right? If you are too immersed in the non-Jewish culture and your non-Jewish co-worker says, look, let's go out for whatever, let's go out to eat, so you might end up going, right? You might end up going to a non-kosher restaurant. You might end up going, and maybe you'll say that I'm just going to have a salad, right? But you might not end up having a salad, right? There's all types of things that could happen, and all those are included under the broader rubric of quote-unquote intermarriage, meaning up to including intermarriage. Yeah?
Yeah, the tam is the same, though, whether it's a derabanan or deraita mitzvah? Same reasons, or it would be different? You would learn...
Not necessarily, right? It could be that deraisa, right? You could say that this is derabanan, or you could say it's deraisa, right? You could say it's rabbinic or biblical, right?
You
but
the reason is the boy...
right? If it's to distance yourself from idolatry, most of those in the first chapter are rabbinic.
Right.
If it's about Now, the truth is that many of the chatnut ones, like Bishul Akum, like not having food cooked by non-Jew, are also rabbinic, right? You could really divide this and say both of them are rabbinic, both of them are biblical. That didn't quite happen that way.
Distancing yourself from Avodah Zarah, meaning you shouldn't come to perform Avodah Zarah yourself?
Or, well, not really perform, right? Be involved in culturally, sort of backhandedly.
That's the greatest of the categories, because the Pusik says that the last part of that Pusik is, okay, your sons and daughters go straight after their gods.
Correct.
So this entire premise is kind of...
Now, correct, meaning even intermarriage itself may be part of a broader cultural phenomenon that itself can lead to idolatry, for sure. Now, obviously, in a non-idolatrous culture, that's not what you're expecting, barring the return to paganism. Parents now are wondering, what am I talking about? It's okay, if you look at the New York Times, it was 3 weeks ago or so, it documented the return to neo-paganism, so that is a thing. Ayin Sham, you can look there. Fine. But the second school is taken by the Ritva, the Raivet, Rav Yom Tov Asvili, which is just a fancy way of saying from Seville. If you didn't know that, that's from Seville. Raivet, who is the Raivet? What's his name?
Abraham ben David.
From? Poski Heirs. Good. Yeah. I'm going to pretend to parents that someone knew that. Rav Avram ben David of Poski Heirs. They argue that, in fact, the prohibition at hand is biblical. The Taz, Rav David Halevi Segal, takes this further and argues not only is it biblical, but it is biblical. He says, what is the verse from which this prohibition is derived? Yudi, I know you looked this up. So what does it say? Right?
The Pasuk?
Yeah.
It says the whole pasuk.
What's the context?
The context is lest you will make covenant.
Good.
Literally, lest you make covenant with them.
Correct. Exactly. The Taz notes, right? Rav David Halevi Segal notes that if you look at the verse that the Gemara is citing, the concern is pentechrot brit. You might make a covenant. So the Taz says, wait a second. The prohibition here isn't about you might sort of backhandedly be involved in idolatry. It's that in certain circumstances, we want you to be distant from the idolaters. And therefore, he says, how can you say that this is permitted because of animosity? The whole point is to create a level of animosity. Maybe not radical hatred, but, you know, friction, that's a good word, friction. And therefore, you can't tell me I'm going to tell you to go to the party to avoid friction. The reason I don't want you to go to the party is to create friction. Right? That would be quite counterproductive if I said you can waive all prohibitions which want to create friction between you and non-Jews because it will create friction. Right? That would make no sense. Therefore, authorities who follow Shach, who follow that school of thought, will tell you, can you go to an office party where it's not idolatrous, it's not actually idolatrous, there is a monetary need to go, there's a social need to go to make sure your boss doesn't hate you, right? What would they say?
Sure.
You're allowed to go. If you're of the Taz's school of thought, that it's about that sometimes we want to create a little bit of friction, so then what would you say? So maybe not. Now we discussed this more in depth, if you remember when we did this together, there are some exceptions, right? It could be, and this is, I put it in seven quickly, there are Baruch Chaim Hirschfeld or some Rosh Kollel in Cleveland or something, suggests that maybe even the Taz would agree that an office party is different, because he said, maybe even the Taz would say, look, what type of party is prohibited? One which is, at its core, social. But a business party, an office party, even though it has a social component, at its core, it's about
business.
Yeah, it's bonding for the sake of improving business, right? Improving the functioning of the office, right? Offices function better if people are friendly. But therefore, it was never really social at its core. So maybe even people of the Taz's school would say, look, a business party, an office party, not such a big deal. Now, there is another... So let's say that's true. And we noted that there are other ways of dealing with this. We noted that the Gemara introduces that the type of party that's prohibited is only one that needs an invitation. Right? A mass email to the whole office, come to our office party on December 20th or December 28th, might not count. Right? It might be too informal. And as we saw, this prohibition seems to be limited, or at least according to many authorities, is limited to formal parties. An office party, which is more like a drop-in with, you put a sign up on the office board, or you send out a mass email, that might not count because of the nature of the invitation, though we noted some modern authorities who weren't sure about that. But there are definitely ways of dealing with going to this party. There is an added problem, which is, once you get to the party, what are you going to eat? Now, food is not such a problem. I mean, it can be. It can be a kosher problem. But I assume everybody knows that that's at least a potential issue, and we'll deal with it accordingly. And to be fair, most businesses are usually pretty good about this if they have a nice number of Jews. It's not so hard, right? I mean, until recently, I'd say you get Entenmann's. But isn't Entenmann's becoming non-kosher? Isn't this the Yeah, everyone's like, oh my God, Entenmann's are becoming not kosher. Yes, this is why now I'm happy. I made Aliyah. There's no Entenmann's. It's not worth being in America. Fine. No, not really. But fine. It's not so hard.
For making Aliyah, we're in trouble.
What?
I said, that's your only reason
for exactly. Please, I made Aliyah 6 months before anyone heard that it wasn't going to be coached. No, that's not true. I made it 5 years before. But that's not fine. Fine, Max. It's fine. What? Okay. So, very briefly, the Gemara introduces a prohibition against drinking beers with non-Jews. However, the Talmud introduces this and said this one is a bit different. While most of the prohibitions about food that is created by non-Jews are about creating, meaning if a non-Jew cooked it, it is prohibited, regardless of where you eat it, right? The non-Jew could have cooked it 3 months ago and now it's been in the freezer and you're eating it by yourself alone at midnight crying, or, I don't know, whatever. Doesn't matter, right? It would still be prohibited. Sheikh Harakum is contextual. It is only prohibited in the place of selling, or a pub, a bar. So this, while it may be a problem if you go to a bar, realistically is not going to be a problem at most parties because it's not a bar. Right? The majority of poskim say, even if you're going to have alcohol, if the context is not one of primarily alcohol, it's a restaurant and you happen to be getting a drink, that's permitted, right? The way many of the authorities understand it is that the prohibition being introduced by this is having alcohol in a context of abandon, let's say, okay? To say that very formally, right? A place like a pub, a bar, where the culture is about drinking. An office party is not primarily that. There may be a bar there, right? There may be spiked punch, but the culture is a... Right, that's not all there is. There's also food. It's also, I don't know, end of year roasts. I have no idea what they do with these things. Right, and surprisingly, since I've been chinuch my entire life, we don't have end of year, Christmas, New Year's. It just doesn't happen. We don't have those parties. I know that's shocking. Even I've just never had it. So that doesn't seem to be a real problem. However, there is this something just to keep in mind, which is what the Chachmas Adam says, which is says that sometimes, even if it's not formally prohibited, right? Sometimes, even if we can permit it, and again, I don't want to get into exactly why, there are also limitations of what type of alcohol counts. He notes that still there's a more generic prohibition called Moshev Leitzim, not to be among scorners. And if the culture is going to be one of drunkenness, it doesn't really matter whether it's technically prohibited. Right? Halacha also has meta values. And he warns people to avoid situations like that, and therefore, if that's the case in the party, try to avoid it, right? Either avoid the party or avoid that part of the party, however you want to take it. But basically, in terms of holiday parties, just to summarize, there's definitely room to be lenient if you believe that the only prohibition against going to parties is actual idolatry, and it's waived for monetary loss, and when it creates animosity, so then there's nothing to talk about, it's permitted. Even if you think like the Taz, there might be room to say this is not such a formal party, or look, it's a business party in the end of the day, it's not primarily social. And in terms of the alcohol, assuming there's food there as well, the culture is not just like going to a bar. Now, if you're going out to a bar as an end of year sort of get together, then you might actually have more issues. But assuming that's not the case, there are people who do this. But assuming that's not the case, it would likely be permitted. Though again, the meta values are worth keeping in mind. Yeah.
Is
Wouldn't alcohol like lead to a greater? I mean, if the whole idea, or if one of the big ideas is.
Absolutely, and this is one of the ironies that we discussed when we did the sugya more extensively, is that the way the Rishonim limit the prohibition of alcohol, where they say this is only at a bar, but not, ironically, if you go and move into the non-Jew's house, or if the non-Jew moves into your house, both of those would be permitted, which you would think is more intimate, leads me to believe, very briefly, that the way the Rishonim at least understood this prohibition was that it's not that interaction with non-Jews are prohibited. Right, the Chazal are not trying to prevent you from ever having interaction with non-Jews. What they are trying to do is have a certain type of controlled environment. And yes, at a certain level, inviting a non-Jew to your house is more intimate than a bar. But on the other hand, there's more control in that situation. And Chazal balance, on the one hand, a desire to keep a level of distance, right, to prevent over intermingling of the cultures, with a recognition that we don't want absolute division between the cultures, right? And the
is that true,
and
is, do we not want absolute division?
So it seems not, right?
Why?
I mean,
why not?
And it's not clear that we don't value that, right? That we don't value a level of interaction, right? I mean,
why?
I don't know why you assume
we.
Well, like I said, Tosfot thinks that it's totally fine to have your good friend come over to your house and have alcohol, or even go to his house and move into his house and have alcohol at his house.
He's a mekel.
And it's Nifsak in Shulchan Aruch, or that's in Shulchan Aruch, the Halacha. Again, where do you see this idea? Look, the way I heard it once from Aaron Soloveitchik, I believe, was that he thought that Halacha didn't want a non-Jew to be your confidant, your best friend, right? That's already a level of relationship that's too much. But a basic level of fraternity, right, a recognition of the equal humanity of all people, and that's something I think Halacha values. Now, I admit, there are going to be plenty of people will tell you, no, we only want you amongst Jews, we don't see value in it. That's not the world I come from. I mean, admittedly, I don't really have many close non-Jewish friends. That's just the nature of rabbinical school, or YU in general. That's just life. But at a fundamental level, right, I don't think it is something Halacha is opposed to. Right, but this is a broader philosophical discussion. No, philosophical and halachic discussion, which has to be had, not right now, because we do want to have Marev in a few minutes. But we'll have it. Yaakov will have it, okay? Yuri, yeah.
It doesn't really seem to. The Gemara earlier talks about anything that's Kovei Asuda, you should avoid, you know, having with a gut. You can't have bread, you can't have.
No, you can't have things that's produced by them, right? These are two different types of prohibitions.
So there's that concept, and there's the concept of having it together with the guy.
No.
Wasn't the
extent of that exists is in Mesibah Yaakov.
The Isser of Shevet, for example, originally was because you don't want to sit down or have anything that could maybe consider.
So again, this is where you have to balance it, right? That the right, some of the prohibitions are about production, some of them are about context. All of them are trying to limit the extent to which we have interaction with non-Jews, but not eliminate them. Right, they're all crafted with enough exceptions that they're clearly not meant to eliminate interaction. There is no prohibition to just sit down with one non-Jew. Right? There's no such thing. Right, how big a party might be, but there is no such prohibition. And that's more later, by the way, not earlier.
So,
right,
so
that stuff is all in the lamed.
The issue of what the Torah wanted to prevent by saying, you know, the issue of chasanus was not about sitting down with Goyim in their house, it was about partying with them?
So not according to Tosfot, right? Not according to Tosfot, right? Tosfot is very careful in what he thinks it is, right? It's a very particular type. Now, that doesn't mean we love it, but there's a recognition you can't cut off all interaction with the non-Jewish world. It's not, either it's not possible if you want to be minimalist, or it's not an ideal if you want to be maximalist in terms of our how much relationship we want non-Jews. I'm not going to take a firm stance on it now, and I think it's something that needs to be thought about. But we are running short on time. Yeah.
So I'm kind of confused on what the Chachmas Adam is saying, because he's saying that it's usher for beers, but then it's permitted for like certain wines and coffee.
Okay, so I don't want to. You were there for the longer share where we went into this. The Chachmas Adam argues, based on Ramah, that formally the prohibition may only apply to very specific types of alcohol. The Ramah specifically says date beer, but his argument is that even if that's true, right, even if there are very few alcohols that will formally be prohibited to drink with non-Jews, that doesn't mean it's a good idea, Right? And there's more general prohibitions, and right in the context, he also says that having a coffee with them in the wrong context may also be problematic. Right? The wrong context there being a coffee house, but not what we know is not Starbucks. Right? Right? The dens of sedition, as King Charles referred to it. Parents, I mean that literally, right? King Charles referred to coffee houses as dens of sedition. They were actually, there used to be a different culture at coffee houses than they have now. Okay, I think. Fine. Let us, yeah, Ellie, you have a question.
This is a question I'm thinking.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was here. I didn't scroll down. But I want to know, back in the parties, if there's a, Kalisha there, is that a consideration?
What?
Of the Kalisha? Look, Kalisha potentially. Kalisha is a broader discussion, obviously, the halacha. Big Adol, basically, I'd say, look, if, you know, even if you take the more prohibitive stances, if it happens to be in the background, you know, there's definitely room to just go and whatever, don't pay attention. That's not what you're doing, right? If it's a concert, right? So then, you know, obviously, that's going to be more more problematic. If it's in the background, you know, I mean, I don't know how many of these office parties have like live music, right? If it's not live, so then there's all types of other shit. What?
Karaoke is probably more problematic.
Oh, karaoke. That's an interesting question. That is more live and that is more central. Yeah, so then it might be a potential issue. Again, there is a lot of room in Psak. Obviously, there's some poskim who are lenient in general on listening to Kalisha. Even ones who are not will. Many of them will say, look, even if you shouldn't do it lachatrila, to be there while it's happening. And again, a lot of these parties are you know, stopping. You don't have to be there the whole time, right? But that does deserve an entire discussion of in and of itself. It can, again, it can be an issue, depending on exactly how you paskin, exactly the context. Okay, let's quickly try to get through the next two, okay? Greetings. What might be wrong? What issues might arise with saying Merry Christmas, New Year? Yes. Okay. Yeah.
I wonder if going to such lengths to impose the friction you speak of ironically attaches more religious significance to the holiday for us than to even most non-Jews. Chances are there won't be a creche at the party.
So again, as I noted, the context here is not about Christmas parties, right? If it were a holiday party, it might be a problem. Okay, Ellie. Basically, look. Well, we noted, Yaakov, sit down. This is just distracting. Just sit. So basically what we note is, look, even if it's true, look, if it's actually a Christmas party, there may be other problems. What I discussed here is independent of whether it's a Christmas party, a mid-year party, an end-of-year party, doesn't matter. This is about parties in general, right? So it's not ascribing any significance to the party, right? Just saying there's a problem with interactions that have happened at parties, full stop. Right, it's not about the religious aspect per se, right? I'm sidestepping it because it's not really the issue that comes up. Okay, let's run through the next two. Greetings. What issues might come out in terms of greetings? So there are two potential issues let's say three issues very quickly, okay? One is there may be a problem in general with greeting non-Jews. That's one. And that is introduced by the Gemara in number 8. Where the Gemara says, a person should not enter the house of idolaters on their holidays and greet them with shalom. If he finds him in the market, he can respond quietly and with seriousness. However, the majority of modern commentaries follow the position of Shachin number 9, who says that there is no prohibition to greet non-Jews. The problem is specifically shalom, because, Yaakov, why shalom? Because it's the name of God. Right? And therefore, attaching the name of God to an idolater might be more problematic. So, greeting non-Jews, the majority of modern authorities, who just greeting them is not a problem. Okay, bigger problem is Merry Christmas, right? Is there a problem in saying that because it includes the word Christ, which is the name of an idolater, of an idol, potentially. So, this is based on a prohibition number 10, where the Talmud says that there is a prohibition of lo yishama al picha. You cannot cause the name of an idol be heard by your mouth. And therefore, even eliciting a response of Merry Christmas could potentially be a problem if you're causing them to invoke the name of an idol. Now, this is a little bit complicated for a few reasons. One is that it's not clear that Christianity is considered Avodah Zarah. Right? Islam is probably not, with the exception of Iran. The majority of modern poskim, except Tzitzil Eliezer, who follows the Iran, thinks that Islam is not idolatry. But there is a big machloket between the Ramban, the Behuda, and others about Christianity. So basically, very quickly, Tosafot wrote in several places introducing the notion that if you're in a business deal with a non-Jew, the Talmud says you're not supposed to do that because you might end up in a case where there is a situation where there's a legal fight between you and the non-Jew, and he will have to make a vow, and the vow will invoke the name of an idol, and that will be a problem. The Rama interprets this to mean, Tosafot says, however, nowadays it is permitted because the vow he will make is only shituf, and shituf is not a problem. Now, shituf means the combining of things. What does Tosafot mean? So the Rama writes, what he means is that Trinitarianism, even though it does believe in multiple parts to a God, for non-Jews is not idolatry. The Nozbi Yehuda says it's not true. Christianity is idolatry. Catholicism is idolatry. What does shituf mean? It means that a Jew can't say, I swear by God and by Yuri, because it's just disrespectful to God. As much as we love Yuri, he's not on the level of God. But a non-Jew, if he wants to say, I swear by God and St. Peter, whatever, it's not an idol. Right? And whatever, so it's disrespectful to God. That's not his problem. Non-Jews aren't held to the same standard. But Christianity is Avodah Zarah. So you basically have this divide amongst those who follow the Rama and say Christianity is not Avodah Zarah, and those who follow the Yehuda. The Rambam says this explicitly, that Christianity is idolatry. So, does that mean it is a problem to say Christ? So, there's a big dispute amongst modern poskim. Some poskim say, yes, there's a problem to say Christ. I will put out the disclaimer. I'm saying this lav and laharos, you understand what I'm saying. So even if what I'm saying should be us or it's not us, or okay, fine. Why that's true is complicated, but it is. Some poskim say, yeah, you can't say Christ. Other poskim say you can. But they say maybe, this is Rechaim Pinchas Scheinberg says, maybe you can't say Jesus and Christ together. Because then it's, right, Jesus is a first name, Christ just means Savior, right? None of those are really God names per se. If you put them together, then you're ascribing a level of spiritual importance to a particular person. Maybe that's a problem. There are a variety of modern approaches. However, for the most part, this is irrelevant. Because, as Shulchan Aruch notes, this is only if you're actually saying the name of the idol. But if the name of the idol happens to be included in the name of a holiday, right, it's not prohibited. And this is what the Shulchan Aruch says in 12, that there's no concern regarding mentioning names of their holidays, which are like the names of people, so long as one does not do what the idolaters do respectfully. Right, it's not... The way Shulchan Aruch takes it is that the name of a holiday is not a problem. I mean, even if it might have a... might have the valence of idolatry, right? Christmas isn't an idol, right? At best, it has a word that itself might be referencing an idol, but the word Christmas refers to December 25th. And therefore, it doesn't seem to be a problem to say the word Christmas. However, what does Shulchan Aruch say? What can't you do? You can't say it in a way that ascribes it seriousness. And therefore, the majority of poskim, I don't actually know of any poskim who argues on this, though I've seen people do it anyways, say that saying Merry Christmas is a problem. Right? Because even if it's not the name of an idol, you are, by wishing someone a Merry Christmas, you are, right, explicitly recognizing the significance of December 25th. Doesn't matter, right? You're saying that this is something worth acknowledging, and therefore, and Ray Willig is very, you know, strong about this, but it seems to be what Shulchan Aruch says. You can't talk about their holidays in a way that ascribes it seriousness. Wishing someone a Merry Christmas seems to be problematic. Now, there are poskim who say, well, what about Happy Holidays? Happy Holidays is interesting, right? That might be more, it might, right, when I throw this out to people, some people have the inclination that it's no better than Merry Christmas, because everyone knows what you mean. Other people say, no, that's part of the liberal society that we live in that's trying not to ascribe specific importance to any given religion. It's trying to wrap everything up in an end-of-year happy season. So Happy Holidays is probably better than Merry Christmas in that regard. Ray Willig has this thing where he says that he thinks Happy New Year is fine because he has this... What?
Has pagan roots, though.
So, but here's his argument. He said, Because you can read it two ways. Or this is very nitpicky. But he says, you can look at it two ways. When you say Happy New Year, what do you mean? Do you mean happy, now quote, New Year, like New Year's Day, enjoy your January 1st? Or do you mean have a good new tax year, right, or whatever, right? Meaning have a new year, the next 365 days should go well for you. He says, as long as you have in mind, not Happy New Year's like the chalos of the day, right, which the Ramah talks about, Nayayar, the New Year day, but instead you mean like, you know, I hope that the tax rate goes down this year and you make money in the next 300, whatever, right? Have in mind whatever you want, right? The new year, not the New Year's Day, but the new year and wishing someone a new year where it has legal implications, it has implications that are not religious, that are purely secular, purely practical, right? The, you know, the end of the finances for this year, right? Things like that. That he thinks is much, much easier. So, you know, Happy New Year. Merry Christmas seems to be problematic. Happy Holidays is somewhere in between. Happy New Year, you can probably get away with. Okay? Last issue quickly. Gifts and tips. Okay. Yeah.
How about a good... Good Gebenstier?
Good Gebenstier?
Yes.
That's probably the same. Saying in Yiddish will probably help you. Okay, look, I'll tell you a quick story. The truth is that a lot of these things can be solved if you are quick on your feet. Ray Friedman likes telling this story, so any of the Rambam guys may have heard it. But when Varon Soloveitchik was in the hospital after one of his strokes, I think he was in the hospital around Easter. So on the Friday before Easter, the nurse came in and wished him a Good Friday. So how did he solve the problem?
It's a Good Friday.
I wish you a Good Friday, and a Good Saturday, and a Good Sunday, and a Good Monday. Right? He, you know, if you're quick on your feet, you can come up with something that will be friendly, will make everybody happy, but will not ascribe significance to the religion. Right? Friedman loves that story. I've heard it so many times from him when I was in high school. Okay, fine. Quickly, gifts and tips. So, there are two potential issues, okay? One is, there may be a prohibition of giving gifts for free, right? Matnot chinam, to non-Jews at all. And that's what the Gemara says in 20a. Lo tichanem, don't give them something for free, don't give them gifts for free. There are two major limitations on this. One is that the Meiri and the Tzitz Eliezer, Eliezer Waldenberg follows him, say this only applies to idolaters, but not non-Jews nowadays, or Gedurim Begidrei HaDatot. And therefore, many modern poskim say, look, whatever this prohibition was, it applied to early pagans. Again, this may depend on whether you think Christianity is Avodah Zarah or not. That's one issue. The bigger issue is that the consensus amongst poskim is that there's only a potential problem of giving someone a gift for literally for free. And we're very loose at what that means. So it only really applies to someone, as Shulchan Aruch writes in 16, an idolater or a non-Jew that you don't know. Why? Because look, pure, to use the language of Adam Smith, pure beneficence, or what we call in modern English, benevolence, is meant to be aimed at Jews, at your brothers, right? To go around, find a random non-Jew, give him a present, which you could give to a Jew, which you could give to tzedakah, you could use for something else, is problematic. However, if it's part of a relationship, it's your mailman, it's your coworker, right? Why are you giving them a present? Not just to be nice, but because you have a social relationship where you both benefit. So sometimes you give them presents, they give you presents, right? Why do you give your postman, right, or your superintendent a gift at the end of the year? Not because, right, not because you want to, you're magnanimous, but because you want them to be nice to you, right? They want... and therefore, the consensus among poskim is that when there's someone you have a relationship with, so your employees, your employer, your whatever, when you give them a gift, that's fine. Because we understand it's not for no reason. It's part of building a relationship that's important in your life. Which again comes back to the broader question, what types of relationships would we be having with non-Jews? But let's assume that you are, right, and that's okay, which is the assumption here. So Shulchan Aruch says that's fine. So there's no problem with giving a gift per se. What about around the holidays? So, as you know, the whole first parak talks about a prohibition to send a non-Jew a holiday present because it might lead them to go to their house of idol worship and say, thank you, whatever god, for Jupiter, Zeus, for sending a present to me. How do we solve this? So, based on a whole series of complicated halachot in the first perek, the basic consensus is, how do we solve this? The Ramah says, this is only if it's sent on the holiday itself.
Outside of
Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, the Ramah says, well, and they did what modern poskim say, you want to solve the problem, it's easy. You want to give an end of year present? Do it. Just don't do it on December 25th.
Would it be a problem the whole time between December 25th and January 1st?
No. I know it's technically part of the 12 days of Christmas or something, but no. Right? It's on the holiday itself. So they say, and you know what? You want to be safe? So all post can say, how many people think that your coworker is going to be upset if you give it to them on December 20th, right? Or your employee, right? You're a boss. You're giving them an end of year bonus. You give it to them 5 days before Christmas so that they can go and buy their meals, you know, benachat. No one's going to complain. They can have money for an extra vacation, right? No one's going to complain. So give it to them the 20th, give them the 15th, whatever you want, right? You can easily solve this problem by making it an end-of-year gift and not putting it on the holiday. So practically, that's the easiest way to do it. If you forget to do that, it has to be on the holiday, there is room to be make it, which the Ramah says, right? If you can't do it, you can't manage to get it to before, and you have to do it on the holiday, you are allowed to, for, again, complicated reasons I can't get into. But the ideal way of solving this problem is to do it not on the holiday itself, which, again, for anyone who's learned the first parak, you know that by the time we get to the position of Shmuel, that's basically what we rule, that outside of Eretz Yisrael, outside of Israel, we limit the problems to the day of the holiday itself. So as long as it's not the day of the holiday, it is presumed to be permitted. Yeah?
Just a question for a parent. What about giving away clothes, like non-Jewish organizations?
Right, so that's a bit different, because Tztaka, the Gemara in Gittin, and Daf Nun Tes, says that we do have a notion of Mefarnesin Ani Akum Im Ani Yisrael, that we give Tztaka to non-Jews along with the Jews. How exactly, literally, that means with non-Jews, that's a bit different. But yeah, but charity is different than a gift for no reason. That's part of a broader concern, a broader value. And again, whether that's a practical thing of making sure there's no animosity, or a fundamental value that we think expressing our humanity, which is the way Rabbi Soloveitchik took it, right? That the reason we give tzedakah is not just to be, you know, so they don't hate us, but is actually because of a broader recognition of the value of human life, right? That's not going to be a problem, because that's not called for no reason. That's called a halachic value. Okay, we really do have to get to Marav. Yes, so let's. We're going back to the original time we said, because we ended up starting about when we said we were going to.
Very simply, for Jews to treat any of these holidays like anything generally holy is not appropriate. Doing so sarcastically is a quiet inside joke to another Jew in a separate manner, but would probably be offensive to a non-Jew.
That may be. What? I'm not sure I understood that. I think it was a statement. But, okay. That may be true, but I'm not. Maybe you can get a clarification for me, but probably after the show, because we really got to Daven Marav. Okay. Thank you for joining us. We do have to get to Marav. We'll do this at some point again. I don't know exactly when, but we'll let you know, okay? Guys, let's.